I was a teenage boy in junior high at one point. Do you think the other kids didn't realize that my name backwards was Nad? They actually, this is a real stretch from my, my peers or classmates in 7th, 8th grade. But they tried to make it so my last name backwards, they convinced themselves was Tracker. And so they called me Nad Tracker, like I was tracking Nads down all the time.
Which is what you were doing.
Right, I had my Sherlock Holmes outfit and, you know, the magnifying glass looking for Nads.
I understand why they made the effort to stretch it, because that is, in fact, what you were doing. You had that radar on
of
your
course.
Belt at all times.
It was like the guy with the thing at the beach mm-hmm. looking for, like, coins and stuff like that. I was just constantly on the search for Nads.
Yeah, within a 5-foot proximity of a Nad, ideally a pair, but sometimes just one.
Sometimes you just get one. Yeah, that's true.
That your radar would go off, and so everyone knew it was impossible to hide it.
Yeah. So there was a time where they tried to get Nad Tracker and
let me
make
ask
it
you
become
something.
A thing. Yeah, please.
Once you found the Nads, what would you do with them?
You can get these special jars that actually they have these little slots you can put individual Nads in.
Oh.
Yeah.
Did it have like formaldehyde in the jar and you would put them
on
display?
It was some sort of science liquid thing. I don't know exactly
science
what
liquid.
It was.
Got it.
Yeah, but it just made sure the Nads stayed, you know, natty, you know, kept all their natty properties intact.
Well, that's very important. You want your Nads to be as natty as possible.
It's true. Yeah, you want the natty Nads. Yes.
Yeah. Don't settle for anything less than
no.
the nattiest. Of Nads.
Don't let anyone tell you any different, all right? People try to scam you. You need some Natty Nads.
And if anyone knows a thing or two about Natty Nads, it's you, the Nad Tracker.
We just loaded up the car full of all my Nad vaults to move to the new house.
Yeah, that's the thing. People talk about what a pain in the ass moving is. Mm-hmm. Imagine moving the regular level of pain in the assery, mm-hmm. and then on top of that, you have several tons, like literally tons, thousands of pounds of Nads that you
have
to
and all the liquid that you have to keep
and
in
all
that's
the
heavy.
Science liquid.
Exactly.
It's a whole to-do.
They're delicate. You got to make sure you're not hitting speed bumps.
It's not something you can entrust in the average mover. There's a specialist team that comes in their hazmat suits.
Uh-huh.
They handle each individual Nad with care.
Well, you get the Nad insurance. Don't skip that.
Of course.
It's costly,
but
you know, Nads can get punctured very easily.
Imagine the cost if even one Nad was lost.
Nad, look, I know we're thinking balls here, but like Nards is funnier.
Nards is funnier.
Nards is way funnier. I think.
But your name isn't Dran.
That's true. I don't know if Dran is the name or not. So I think the kids in seventh grade had to work with what they had, and Nad was backwards. But come on, Nard would have been ideal.
Well, imagine if your name backwards was Acneab.
Yours
try
is
dealing with that growing up.
Wait, yours backwards is Knob. Oh, I was just thinking Bonk.
My name Knob. Backwards is Knob.
Yeah, Bonk backwards is just Knob.
Isn't that
like
what
spelled correctly?
People call boobs Knobs.
I think in England they might call wieners Knobs.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Nads and Knobs.
Nads and Knobs. That's our next podcast we're working on right now. We'll put the feed up pretty soon. Hi.
Hi.
The Deer Hunter.
You want to jump right into it? Usually we let it simmer for a little bit, or was all that Nad talk?
We got a lot of good Nad talk in. I guess other things. I'm looking around right now, and this room is getting emptier and emptier. This Pizone. It's not the first place we podcasted from, but it is the place we've done the most podcasting from. We started on the bed for a few episodes.
Bed was a few.
And then we actually had this table, or a bigger table, in the bedroom back in Manhattan. The Pizone is definitely my favorite place that we have podcasted
great.
From.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just talking before we recorded about not knowing exactly what the next setup's going to be. We have like an office area that we'll probably turn into the new Pizone.
We'll have to get a sign over the door that says, welcome to the Pizone.
We need something like, it's a house now.
Highway to the Pizone.
I was wondering how it was going to work. And the answer was, it doesn't.
what do you think of when you first think of things backwards?
There's a place called Star Mart on College Boulevard and Flum growing up, and it was Tram Rats backwards.
Ooh,
and whenever
good.
I drove past it, I would think, oh, it's Tram Rats.
There was a weird period in my life, and looking back on it, I wonder if I almost had some degree of OCD where every word I saw, I would try to say it backwards in my head.
I did that too.
Yeah. And it was like, I don't do it anymore, but I was literally obsessed with it. And not obsessed in that I would think of it, but when I would look at a word, I would just instantly try to.
Yeah. Anytime driving around the car or something, like you look at any store or anything, I would do that frequently. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know if that's a common thing. I've never really talked to anyone about that.
I don't know, but it was a pretty intense phase in my life. There, and I think that was around the time where I also would try to take letters from a word and try to make different words out of it.
The mix around mm-hmm. Anagram type mm-hmm. thing? Yeah, yeah.
I was obsessed with the word jumble growing up, so I think that's probably what that has to do with.
Those were fun.
The daily word jumble in the newspaper.
I enjoyed those. Those were good.
What I think of when I think of words backwards, though, is that episode of The Simpsons where
Tom Hanks?
It was a music video that had the subliminal messages in it.
Oh.
It was like, Akve Uninaj, and it was like backwards.
Wait, the Mr. Sparkle commercial? The detergent?
I don't know. It was like a subliminal messages to get you to join the military or something.
Oh, there was in the Navy one, right?
Probably.
It's like a newer one. Well, newer.
Is that newer? I mean, it was when I was watching when I was a kid.
I feel like that's post season 10, so that probably would have been like 2000-ish.
It probably maybe. Was. Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah. Yes. Not new, but post prime.
The one I always think about was Simpsons. I thought you were going towards was they're in the movie, waiting for the movie to start.
Uh-huh.
Might be in the Sideshow Bob one, but it's like, oh, word jumble. Who is this actor or whatever? Mm-hmm. And it's like, OTM, and then like Hanks, but like one letter is off, and it's just looking at it, your brain instantly registers it as Tom Hanks. Yeah, I like that one.
I used to love going to the theater early, and not super early, but early enough to see like the pre-coming attractions, pre-coming attractions.
Well, that's a certain theater.
Yeah, that's a certain theater. Yeah, it was back in the 80s in New York City. Like the ones where it would be like Maria Menounos interviewing some person from like a new series on NBC or some shit.
Totally. Yeah, some partnership with the theater or something.
Like, oh, here's a movie fact. After the break, we'll give you the answer.
Yeah, after the break, it's like, this is a commercial that we're watching already.
Yeah.
I working in the theater as long as I did, I definitely like when I was ushering and stuff, you know, they would play some of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, every single thing that played in an AMC theater between like 1999 and 2003, mm-hmm. It's just every movie tracks song that played on repeat, everything that aired before every movie, every ad. I just knew everything. Just gets over and over and over again.
When you were working there, is there one movie that stands out in your head as the one you've seen the most of? Like just by virtue of like you really liked it, so you would sneak in and watch it, or you just were walking past it a lot and.
I mean, I would just sit down and watch movies. I would never, ever even be on my radar. Mm-hmm. Just because, like, if you were ushering, if you had everything cleaned up and everything, and, you know, the hallways weren't dirty or anything, it was pretty easy to just sit down and check out, like, 40 minutes of a movie. And you would, like, kind of, like, space it out and be like, oh, I caught, like, the middle 40 minutes of this. I'll catch the beginning this time or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But the one that probably came out during my, like, tenure there that I've seen the most, honestly, back then, probably Fight Club. I mean, because I was a 14, 15, 16-year-old boy. I was like, this is deep philosophy. And, like, I had to watch it a million times to understand how the intellectuals thought, you know. And it's like, now as an adult, it's like, okay, all right.
I mean, I think the movie gets a bad rep now because – or a bad rep or rap?
Both work.
Whatever. Rep rap.
Whoa.
Because I think a lot of people have that similar experience where it's kind of like, okay, when you were a kid, you thought this was edgy and really intellectual. But looking back, I mean, it's, you know, kind of a little try hard, but it's a perfectly fine movie.
But then it's like, I haven't seen it in so long. And now when I hear people talk about it, it's like, I hear that the thing is that the people that were so obsessed with it and thought it was so deep and everything didn't pick up on the fact that it was like satire of like kind of that ultra masculine type mm-hmm. thing. And like, so I've never seen it through like an older lens where like, I wonder if I would see that now because I haven't seen it since mm-hmm. I was probably like a teenager.
Maybe
or early college.
Should watch it again. Yeah, because I didn't pick up on that. And that could just be because I'm not like as privy to or sensitive to that type of stuff.
Sure, sure.
But I mean, I feel like I've seen it somewhat recently. Probably within the last 10 years.
Yeah, I'd be curious what I take away now, not being a dumbass like 15-year-old that thought it was the deepest thing I'd ever heard of, you know?
Bret Easton Ellis, he's the author.
No, Chuck Palahniuk.
Oh, Chuck Palahniuk, yeah.
Bret Easton Ellis was American Psycho.
That's right.
Rules of Attraction, yeah.
Yeah, Chuck Palahniuk definitely has that style of writing.
Yes.
There's similar themes across all of the books of his that I read.
It's all really just like, oh, isn't this dark and fucked up?
Yeah.
Like, oh, I was in a pool and I sat on a jet and it pulled out my intestines through my butt or something. Yeah. That's actually in one of his books. But
the one I remember is like, it was, I think it might have been Choke.
Yeah,
it was,
I read that one.
Was it the one with the sex addict that like fucks some girl in the bathroom?
I think
right
that was Snuff. Choke was the one who the guy like needed attention by going into restaurants and pretending
right,
to choke.
Right.
And then like a rich person sometimes, if you were at a nice restaurant, would like save you and then have this connection with you and send you money and stuff all the time. There was one called Snuff that was more kind of sex focused. Mm-hmm. I don't remember. Maybe the character in Choke was. I don't remember.
Yeah.
Survivor was the one where the guy in the cult plane. Was on the plane. Yeah. I've read a handful of his. Yeah, I remember enjoying his books when I read them. I just wonder how I would feel now. It's just, I wonder if I would see it as like kind of edgelord stuff or whatever.
There's definitely an element of that for sure.
Yeah.
And he never wrote women well. I've always been.
I can't imagine.
Really? Yeah. Just. I mean, yeah. It's. What are you going to do? He's an edgy man. I think he's gay.
Yeah.
He's like very singularly focused on the male experience, which is fine. Whatever.
Yeah, I have not checked out his books or his movies or movies based on his stuff in a long time. So, I don't know.
Shrug, am I right?
Shrug indeed, yes. Speaking of, okay, do a segue from Shrug into Deer Hunter.
You know, it's easy to shrug off some of the difficulties of life, but it's harder to shrug off having to play Russian roulette every day while you're in captivity by the Viet Cong.
Cog?
Isn't it Viet Cong?
It's Gears of War?
Viet Cong?
Yes. Viet Cong. Boy, when I'm the one spitting the Vietnam facts here.
Listen, if that's the thing about this movie. You know, everyone thinks it's about Vietnam, and they were all like, Vietnam soldiers didn't do Russian roulette. Well, that's true, but the Viet Cong did.
Oh, this movie was showcasing the Viet Cong, the little known side of the Vietnam War.
The wheel
War.
In the sky keeps on turning,
that's
baby.
That's what the song's about.
About the Viet Cong.
Over the Viet Cong, yes.
Having people shoot themselves in the face. Okay. Imagine you are being held captive by enemy soldiers.
Okay.
And they give you a gun and say there's one bullet and you have to put it by your temple and fire and you might live, but chances are, well, 1 in 6 chances are that you will die.
Mm-hmm.
How would that make you feel?
What do you think? Well, how do you expect me? This is like when we're watching wrestling and something happens. And I say, like, oh, would that scare you to have to jump off that cage while you're inside a trash can? And you'd be like, yes! What do you expect me to say? That's my answer.
All right, well, I thought maybe you'd say something a little different.
No, the answer is yes!
Well, here's my perspective, which I feel like is totally true and accurate.
Okay.
If I were in that situation, and, you know, I was a prisoner of war, which, of course, I can't even begin to imagine what that would be like, but... You know, if faced with the prospect of being tortured or killing yourself, I feel like killing yourself would be the optimal decision, right?
I mean, yeah, I mean, it's just so impossible to even put myself in that mind state of just like...
It's completely impossible.
It's absolutely. Like, it just sounds like...
But I'm
like
trying to
hellish...
say that I'm better than Christopher Walken and Robert De Niro's characters.
I'm picturing you just cut into that scene now. You're just being real cool about it.
That wouldn't be good.
No.
It would be so bad.
It'd be really bad. Turns out all this Vietnam stuff we're watching, Vietnam seems very bad.
Oh my gosh, it seems terrible.
Like the worst, right? Like I've seen a lot of depictions of war from your Saving Private Ryans to your, you know, wars throughout history depicted on film. Vietnam seems like the worst.
It seems really bad on all sides too, because it's like, you know, everything we know about what American soldiers did over there was pretty shitty as well
in terms of massacres,
know, massacring innocent people. And also it just seemed like, not that any war is really ever justified.
But... I mean, when it's like, hey, let's go kill Hitler. It's like, well, okay, we got a pretty good goal here.
Hitler deserved to die.
Yes, we sent a bunch of folks over there and killed Hitler. Well,
absolutely.
He killed himself, but you know what
well,
I mean.
Yeah. Tried. Yeah, that totally, but in most cases, I feel like, come on, you're gonna, this is sanctioned murder. This is like so absurd. Imagine being in that situation where you can be killed, you can kill, there's just death all around you, and you have to kind of like, I would imagine, remove yourself from your, you know, your human vessel and just kind of sever any connection you have with any human emotion and just become like a machine in order to do this stuff. And then be expected to, if you are lucky enough to survive, go back into society where, while you were in the midst of all that, everyone else was, you know, baking pies and singing songs. I mean, God, it's just ludicrous. I cannot imagine what that would be like.
Well, and then with Nam specifically, it's just like you do all this stuff and then you come back and it sounds like it's not like things were great once you got back on U.S. soil, which we are looking forward to watching Rambo at some point here. But you saying that reminds me of this quote I read while I was reading about some stuff about the production and release and all that. So the producer, Dealey, what was his first name? Last name is Dealey. He said this about the movie. He says, "The Deer Hunter wasn't really about Vietnam. It was something very different. It wasn't about drugs or the collapse of the morale of the soldiers. It was about how individuals respond to pressure, different men reacting quite differently. Mm-hmm. The film was about three steelworkers in extraordinary circumstances. Apocalypse Now is surreal. The Deer Hunter is a parable. Men who fight and lose an unworthy war face some obvious and unpalatable choices. They can blame their leaders or they can blame themselves. Self-blame has been a great burden for many war veterans. So how does a soldier come to terms with his defeat and yet still retain his self-respect? One way is to present the conquering enemy as so inhuman and the battle between the good guys and the bad guys so uneven as to render defeat irrelevant." Mm-hmm. So it's like that idea of like coming back from this war, and it's like they probably all did terrible things. You know, how many people came back and killed people and had to like live with it and then think about like, oh wait, do we blame the government for sending us there, or do I blame myself? I was the one who pulled the trigger. Like, I just can't even begin to imagine what that's like. And it just, again, not ever having PTSD or never having killed a man or anything, like, I just cannot imagine the weight that must carry. And then to come home, and then again, this is a whole thing I'd like to read about more after we watch Rambo and everything. I do know that non-vets were not treated well by the public or portions of the public when they came home.
I think that's a good, that quote, it's a good point about this movie. I read that there was a lot of controversy specifically about the Russian roulette stuff, because that wasn't like a recorded method of
there were no documented cases of Russian roulette in the war.
Right. So, you know, them using it in the movie is kind of like, oh, this is inaccurate. But then the fact that, like, if you zoom out a little, it's not exactly about the war. In fact, like, the war is never really talked about to the extent that, like, even Apocalypse Now, I feel like, was more about Vietnam War than this
more
was.
So, yeah.
Because you're not really seeing any huge grand battles, and like the war, the events of the war itself were just kind of a really small slice of it. They pretty much immediately, from what we see of the war, they immediately get captured and held prisoner.
It's a 3+ hour long movie, and it felt like a half hour of it was in Vietnam, or at least in the war part of it. You know what I mean?
Exactly. And then everything else was just like the consequences of it. Thinking about it that way, about like this less being a war movie and more about these guys reacting to these crazy circumstances and their lives. Like, if you think about it through that lens, the long lead up to the war stuff, that wedding scene, it makes a lot of sense why it's there, because it establishes the characters and what everyday life is like, what their relationships are like, what life is like for, you know, a quote-unquote average person in the United States before being sent off, and, you know, having to deal with that or having to experience something like that's a joyous celebration like a wedding with the looming, you know, knowledge that you'd be going off to war the next day or a few days from then. It's just like, I can't even imagine.
Well, I love the scene in terms of the first, like, the wedding part, which is a fairly long sequence at the beginning where you get to see, like you said, these guys before they go to war. They know they're going to war. And part of this wedding is, you know, they've got their posters up and they're saying like, oh, these guys, let's send them off to war, you know, fight the good fight or whatever. Is you feel like the gravity of the situation and what they're about to experience isn't really, they don't really understand it yet,
right?
Because they see that soldier at the bar at the wedding, and the soldier's just there, just down in shots, just 1,000-yard stare. And, you know, they're just like, oh, let's buy him a shot. Hey, we're going to be one of you. I hope they send us where the bullets are flying. I hope they, you know, like, and then, like, the dude is just looking at him, just like, you guys have no fucking idea, you know?
Yeah.
And then, like, to see the difference between these guys before they go and then after they try to come back is, you know, that's what this movie's about to me.
It's so interesting when you think about, like, the subject matter that's frequently covered by movies and TV. It's usually crimes, it's usually love and romance, and, you know, often war comes up. But unlike something like crime, which is a pretty frequent occurrence, and unlike love, which I feel like many of us have experienced to some degree, war is one of those things that, unless you're there, like, you're not, you're just, you can't really begin to understand it. But thankfully, we have amazing actors like Robert De Niro and Christopher Walken that help us try to understand.
Yeah, this cast is incredible. And real quick, just before we move off the mm-hmm. Russian roulette thing, is some people argued when there was that controversy mm-hmm. about how it didn't really happen in the war, some argued that it was symbolic of like the random violence of Nam and how it just kind of breaks the sanity of normal men. And it's just like, so that is just like a condensed way of, sure, I could see that, where it's just like, hey, what's a quick way? Because we're not going to do a whole movie that's all about the events of Vietnam and the war and all these different things. Like, they kind of get in and get out. Like, mm-hmm. this is a three-act movie, you know, before, during the war, and after.
After, yeah.
And, like, I kind of like that they didn't feel the need to kind of, like, they didn't waste a lot of time in this movie. Mm-hmm. In fact, it kind of, there's a hard cut that I loved from, like, oh, them all hanging out, and they're getting drunk, and De Niro's taking off his clothes, and him and Walken are talking on a basketball court at night, to, like, hard cut, Nam, just mm-hmm. napalm, helicopters, and it's just, like, I like that we didn't need 15 or 20 minutes of transitional, like, all right, packing up, bye totally. To the family and stuff. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah. It is interesting that you said that, and I totally agree. Like, it didn't waste any time, but especially the beginning part was really slow paced.
Yeah.
But I think that was, like, a necessary choice. And also, I mean, just generally, I feel like movies from back then, all the movies that I've seen from back then have a noticeably slower pace than contemporary mm-hmm. movies. But I think that definitely served the plot because it like, that stark contrast from, you know, having this long kind of drawn out wedding and learning who the characters are and how they interact with each other and the different relationships cut to, you know, war.
Yeah.
Like, it's really jarring.
It is. And I was talking to someone before we watched it, a fellow film buff that I work with. And I said, like, oh, we're going to watch Deer Hunter. And he said, like, oh, man, perfect movie. Hell, a lot of just great acting there. You know, if they just took out the wedding thing at the beginning, it'd be a perfect movie. And I think I disagree with that, because mm-hmm. I do think that was very, very important to showing who they were before.
Yeah.
And, like, the stuff, the links they went to make that feel authentic in the production is, like, so De Niro, you know, known method actor, was hanging out with steelworkers in, like, local bars, visiting their homes, just kind of getting a sense of who these guys were. Like, mm-hmm. I love that type of stuff.
Yeah.
And then, well, actually, it was originally going to be Roy Scheider from Jaws, but there were
who
creative
was that
differences.
In Jaws?
Main guy. Chief Brody.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. But creative differences kind of tanked that. And so Universal had him on a 3-movie contract, and they forced him to do Jaws 2 as a result. So that's the only 2 Jaws movies he's in, and he was kind of forced to do it since he dropped out of this. But for the, like, authenticity of this one, each of the 6 main male characters, they carried a photo in their back pocket that was, like, somebody put mm-hmm. this together in, like, pre-Photoshop or whatever, of all 6 of them together as children to kind of, like, enhance that sense of camaraderie. And then the props department made Pennsylvania IDs for everyone. They made, like, driver's licenses, medical, all this stuff from
wow.
Pennsylvania, just to really, like, carry around and get a sense of who your character is
wow.
and stuff like that. So there are the 3 main guys we talked about, where it's the 3 that go to Vietnam. It's, what are their names? It's,
Mike, Steve, and Nick.
Right, Mike, Steve, and Nick. And then there are also the friends back home that mm-hmm. don't go to Nam. Notably, I want to talk about John Cazale here, because, so John Cazale, you've probably heard us talk about him in the past, because mm-hmm. we've covered a lot of his stuff. He's been in 5 movies, and now we've seen all 5 in the last, like, 2 months.
And they happen to be some of the, considered the greatest movies of all time.
Yeah, and he's awesome in it.
Yeah.
He's such a great kind of weasel character.
He's perfect for that. Perfect kind of character actor.
Yeah, and he was dying during mm-hmm. this.
And you
so
could tell.
You could, and they filmed all of his stuff first.
He didn't even get to see the final product because he passed away before then.
Yeah, but he's still so good in this.
Yeah,
he's awesome.
I mean, he's amazing. I was reading that him and Meryl Streep were, I think, married.
They were in a relationship.
They were in
the
a
time.
Relationship.
Yeah.
And obviously he had cancer, and pre-Obamacare, it was impossible to get insurance if you had cancer. You were uninsurable. So I think, like, De Niro paid the ludicrous amount
oh,
that it
wow.
would cost to insure him so that he could be in the movie.
Oh, jeez.
But yeah, it's especially, like, going in with the knowledge that this was his last role and he didn't even live to see the final product. You could tell, like, he just looks very different color, different,
visibly gaunt,
sickly. And yeah, it's sad, but he's still incredible, and he obviously left his mark on cinema for
oh
sure.
Oh my god, yeah. Like, I didn't really know who he was before the last couple months, and now I, like, really have enjoyed him and everything I've seen him in.
Yeah,
which was Godfather 1, 2, Dog Day Afternoon, and The conversation in this, yeah. And so Meryl Streep, she wasn't really known at this time. So she's in this, and she accepted this role knowing that it was going to be, quote, vague stock girlfriend. Mm-hmm. You know, there's not like a lot of defining stuff about her here. She's great in it. But she accepted that role so she could stay with him throughout the duration.
Mm-hmm.
But I did think it was really cool. The director, Michael Cimino, suggested that she write her own lines, which I think that's a really cool idea. And I think that would – I'm not an actor, but I feel like wouldn't that help if, like – if you're a good actor and you take it seriously and you get to choose, you know, what your character would say, obviously, you know, you'd have to run it by everyone. But like, I love that idea.
Yeah.
Like, what do you think your character would say here?
Yeah, I feel like you hear about, like, I don't know if this role is improvised by her or anything, but you hear a lot about improv in the context of comedy. But I think, like, if there was just a stock character that didn't have any, like, defining personality traits or whatever, and you could kind of just be yourself and respond to another character's statements how you would normally respond, not have to try to be funny or anything, just respond like a normal human, it would probably make for a much more natural performance. Not that Meryl Streep needs any help in creating natural performances. She's been, obviously, she's very well known for her acting ability, but yeah, she was great in this. She was really great. I feel like the presence of her character, it always indicates some kind. It's kind of like the rest area in a Resident Evil game. You know what I mean? It just indicates a nice calm, like,
Like an anchor. Just yeah. Like, okay.
Yeah. Like in the wedding scene, in the wedding sequence, I guess I should say, she was there, and it seemed like her and. Her and Nick were, you know, I think Nick proposed to her, right? At the wedding.
Yes, during the wedding.
By the way, very tacky. Don't propose to someone at a wedding.
Probably not the way to do it, no.
and then later when Mike returns, she throws him a party and is like, you know, obviously Mike isn't prepared for the party, but he returns later and, you know, there seems to be something between them. But yeah, she's just, I feel like if I were to attach one word to her, especially in this role, it's grace. She's just a very graceful presence.
Under really rough circumstances.
Well, yes. And you know, she obviously wasn't in the midst of it herself, but having to kind of carry her friends and
deal with the aftermath and like
if you zoom out of this movie a little bit and try to separate it into three distinct chunks, I feel like there's the wedding, which is more like just a snapshot of a more like carefree life, and then just the catalyzing event in the middle of the you know war and capture, and then just like the fallout from that.
And I think they're all important, and I think they're all handled really well.
Well, the last part, the fallout, I feel like, is especially emotionally devastating.
Yeah. We'll get there in a second. Before we get off the wedding sequence, who owned that bar? Because it just seemed like any time of day, they could just walk in there and just roll around on the pool tables and get drunk and just grab liquor bottles, and like, there's no bartender. It's like, is this their bar? Like, first of all, that bar looked awesome. I love the look of that bar.
We should make our basement into a bar since you're not using it.
That's
you know
the
mean?
Dream.
Just like a...
That's the dream.
I mean, you could totally do that if that was your bar. You know what I mean?
I could just roll around on pool table. I could just buy a pool table and roll around on it.
Yeah.
Can I put it in the bedroom?
Have to pay pool. Yeah, that could be our bed.
Can I put it on top of our bed, a pool table?
Yeah. And
okay, it might be hard to play on.
I'll poke you with pool poles to wake you up.
For the record, Bonk was trying to think of pool cues a few times in our history together, and she always thinks they're called pool poles.
Because they should be.
It
they're
is fun
poles
to say.
For pool.
I'm going to teach you how to play pool when we get the pool table.
All right, whatever.
It's
we'll
fun.
See.
Pool's great.
I mean, I will definitely, I'm open to a lesson, but I can't guarantee the results will be ideal.
I think we play once a week. I think you'll start enjoying it. But if you don't, whatever. So yeah, we got the hard cut to Vietnam. I thought that was super effective. And yeah, it's just kind of the one main scene there. So they were POWs. Oh, it just seems like the worst. So it's hot. They're in this like underneath this like hut on the river, and they're getting pulled out to play Russian roulette.
Can you imagine like how, like obviously the act itself would be horrifying. But listening to other POWs get called up and knowing what awaits you.
Well, and you see that a lot with Walken, where he's just kind of breaking down there. And it's just like every time he hears a gunshot go off, he's just like, you know, getting traumatized, obviously. And then there's a second worst cage filled with rats and dead bodies. And so when their friend Steve, right? Yeah, Steve kind of chickens out and kind of just kind of grazes the top of his head at the last second. They throw him into the rat and corpse cage.
Yeah, it's just filling with water. Yeah.
Yeah, and his head is just barely above water. It just seems like the absolute worst.
Now, I don't know how it works in a draft situation like Vietnam, but was there no basic training or anything prior to...
There has to be something,
right?
Right? They're,
I mean,
they're dealing with firearms and stuff. You
know, and just like the mental stuff, too. Like, you know,
there's no way you get a letter in the mail and then you're on a plane the next day. Yeah. Like, there's got to be, like, again, not an expert by any means, but, like, I can't imagine that's how they handle it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, the Russian roulette scene is just a lot of, you know, just, like, a lot of acting happening. Mm-hmm. A lot of just, like,
oh, there's a lot of acting.
There's
sure.
actors acting, for sure, there. But it's good. It's really good. And just going from, like, De Niro's face, even. Mm-hmm. Like, we're cutting straight from, like, the wedding where he's just, like, you know, fresh-faced kid. I think he was, like, 30 or something at the time. But, like, you know what I mean. He's, the whole demeanor is so mm-hmm. different. And
yeah. By the way, Robert De Niro, of the three friends that are in the situation together, he definitely seems to be the one handling it the best. Obviously it's a horrible situation, but he seems to be the one that's like kind of taking control and, mm-hmm. and you know, sneakily advising Nick to, you know, let's try to make our escape.
Let's put three bullets in there.
So they make their escape. This is a pretty cool escape scene. Mm-hmm. And they find a helicopter, and poor Steve, he falls out of the helicopter, and Mike, Robert De Niro, jumps after him, and he, like, just, Steve just shatters his leg. It's so fucking
gross. It's
fucked
up, yeah.
And then at that point, it's kind of like they, Mike and Steve find this, like, South Vietnamese truck and give Steve to the truck, and, like, he ends up in a hospital, and... Nick ends up in a hospital, like, for mental and physical trauma in Saigon. And I think shortly after, Mike returns home at that point, right?
Yeah, well, there's the part where, so, we see Nick walking. He leaves the hospital, mm-hmm. and that's where he's just, like, Saigon is just in the midst of, like, a lot of stuff going on. And, like, he's just kind of walking the streets, basically, and he gets persuaded to come to this gambling den.
Yeah,
basically.
Well, the one scene that they show of him in the hospital, he seems obviously, like, he seems in good physical condition, but he seems very disturbed.
Yes, and that only mm-hmm. intensifies as mm-hmm. things go on here. But yeah, you mentioned Mike going back home, and I thought that was one of the most striking scenes in the movie, is when, like, you know, everyone back home who doesn't know the horrors of what he's going through is like, oh, well, you know, it's just friend stuff, you know, it's like, we're going to put together this, like, we'll get a keg, we're going to get a bunch of beer and get all of his friends, we're going to surprise him, we're going to put up big signs and welcome home and all that. And then, like, you can see him pulling up in the car, and he can see the big sign, and he's like, just keep going, just go to this hotel, mm-hmm. and just totally just ghost the party. And then we see him the next morning, like, kind of, like, watching everyone kind of wake up and leave the house. And that was just such a striking scene to me of, like, of course the friends would think they're doing, like, a nice, friendly thing for him.
Right.
But after all the shit he just went through, the idea of, like, coming back and instantly have to be like, hey, everyone, yeah, let's party! It must be so just, like, how do you flip the switch that quickly?
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, yeah, you kind of, I would imagine that you see reality through a different lens, and something like that just isn't really compatible. That's interesting. And he tries to figure out the whereabouts of Steve, because he doesn't really know exactly where he ended up. And he goes to see his wife, and that was a really sad scene as well, because Steve is essentially, like,
his legs don't work, like, one of his arms doesn't work.
And he just seems mentally not there. And so his wife is kind of in this catatonic state where she's just, like, staring at the wall and, like...
And they've got a kid, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah. Well, I think it's, like, not his kid, but his kid she had with another. Yeah, yeah. But at any rate, yeah, it's really sad. And she tells him that he's at this vet's hospital, and he goes to visit him, and... It's a sad scene for sure.
Yeah, and, like, he's been getting money, though, from Nam, mm-hmm. but, like, they don't know anything about the gambling den stuff, really, with mm-hmm. Christopher Walken. So, but, and they don't know where he is either. It's just, there were several moments in this movie where I was just kind of thinking of, like, oh, this is one of those cell phones changed everything way, because, like, you would all know exactly when, like, there were times where people were surprised, like, wait, Steve's home? He's mm-hmm. back? You know, like, you would know that immediately in the day of social media and texting and all that stuff.
Right.
So, but yeah, it's just like the rest of this movie is just kind of like his friends, Mike's friends, not knowing what he's been through and just not able to, like, relate to him. Like, they go on a deer hunting trip,
yeah.
And that is the deer hunter, you know, that was their thing they did, it seemed.
Mm-hmm.
And that scene with Stan, with John Cazale, where he's just got this gun, he's just being a dumbass with mm-hmm. it and stuff, and just De Niro just flips on a dime. He's like, oh, you want to play games? And he just, like, puts a bullet in there, spins it, and puts it up to his head.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they had a bullet in the chamber for that,
crazy.
For when they shot that. Because, like, obviously, they weren't going to actually risk it, but just to heighten the tension, mm-hmm. They did it. And I guess John Cazale checked, like, a million times just to make sure it wasn't the next one in the chamber before they did it. But there was a live round in that gun.
Oh, my gosh.
And he actually clicked it. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is wild.
And
so scary.
And that was such a cool scene to see De Niro go from, like, you can tell he's trying to kind of find his way back into society mm-hmm. to, like, right then he's like, fuck this, you don't know what, you know, like, mm-hmm. you just saw all that come out, like, all that, like, boiling mm-hmm. rage. And, He's really good.
Man, and this was before the time of, like, you know, therapists and psychiatrists being the norm. And
people taking mental health seriously, just the society taking it seriously. Yeah, absolutely. You know, talking about it. You didn't talk about this stuff. Like, I just can't imagine what they went through. Like, I mentioned to you during some of these VA scenes, I used to volunteer at a veterans hospital when I was a teenager, and they would do, there's actually a scene where they play bingo in a VA, and then immediately, it's not something I think about a lot, or not for any reason, I just... You know, it wasn't like a striking thing. I just would go there. I was the kid that would run around with a roll of quarters, and I would give out quarters when people got bingo and stuff. Yeah, it was me and my grandparents, and, you know, my grandpa was very active. He was in Korea, and he was big with the VA and everything. And I think even as a kid going around, like, all these guys were non-vets that were probably like 50-ish something back then, I would guess. Yeah, and, like, I don't think back then I had any kind of sense. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I'm not an expert in a lot of history stuff, and to the point where sometimes I sounded very dumb talking about stuff. But I do, as I learn more and everything, it's just like, I don't know. I don't know what I'm trying to say other than, like, back then I didn't have a appreciation for, not that I thought, like, oh, these losers in the hospital, but it's just like I had no idea what they had been through.
Yeah, I feel like even growing up, and I'm not that old. I didn't want to say that. I'm almost 30. But, you know, even growing up, I feel like, not too long ago, something like PTSD for Vietnam vets was almost like a joke. Like, I mean,
shell shocked.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it was like a weird character in a movie that people kind of rolled their eyes at.
Yeah, he's a guy with a dingy old army jacket who's, you know, got a tinfoil hat. And,
Or it was that dog with the cupcake having flashbacks to Vietnam. Remember that meme?
That still is kind of a thing. Yeah. Like, that whole, like, 1,000-yard stare, like, oh, I've seen shit, you know, they're in the trees. You know, like, that was, South Park always had, they had a character that was pretty much just that.
And
you know?
I get that, like, reducing something to a punchline is an easy way to digest it, but, like, imagine if that was your actual reality. Like, that's not something you can't separate yourself from. That it's everything. It's all consuming. You know what I mean? It's like I would imagine it taints everything in your life, and you just have to, you know, especially at that time, like you said before, mental health, like, people were aware or empathetic toward people with mental health problems. Like, you just had to keep that all inside, and, you know, people had this expectation that you would return and be somewhat normal, you know, normal meaning like what you were like prior.
You're back. You made it. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, just to, like, oh, I guess I survived that. Crack a beer and go back to whatever. Yeah. It's just so far from the truth. I mean, like, it's just such an unnatural thing for a person to do. I mean, like, even though war has been, you know, relatively common throughout the course of human history, I mean, like, it's still not a natural thing for someone to do, to be given a gun or a weapon and, you know, told to kill other people. It's just bonkers.
Yeah, and it's, you know, we've been watching non-movies lately, and I've been thinking about it more, and, like, thinking about it on a level that, you know, I just, you know me, I tend to think, not that I dismiss stuff, but I tend to not think deeply about a lot of things. And now that I've been, you know, thinking about it more with these movies and everything, I also have to keep in mind that we're just watching movies, you know, movies that actually had controversies about not being accurate. So, like, the actual reality of the situation, you know, these are still Hollywood movies that are depicting horrible things. Obviously, Apocalypse Now and the events of Deer Hunter are absolutely horrible. But I'm sure it's just nothing can compare to what these people and these veterans actually went through.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's impossible to know unless you have that experience in your brain. And even then, it's like, you can't, I can't imagine going through something like that and it not finding its way into every single one of your thoughts, or, like, punctuating every one of your thoughts.
Or, like, even if you're not actively thinking about it, it's just always got to be this thing hovering around, you would think, right? Like,
yeah, I mean, that's just goes to show the importance of, like, not that therapy and stuff can solve everything, but just being able to talk about that and stuff instead of keeping it bottled up. And, you know, it's very important.
Just the general movement, not just in, like, you know, like, veterans and PTSD, but in depression, anxiety, things like that. I just feel like in the last 5-10 years, maybe, it is just leaps and bounds. Because, you know, again, when I started having, like, anxiety stuff, I tried to hide it from everyone just because I thought it'd be like, oh, people are just going to say he's crazy, you know? So, like, it's just, it is very nice to see it talked about so much more openly now.
Right.
You know, all forms of mental illness.
Yeah, of course.
Like that, so.
I mean, yeah, at the end of the day, your brain is, you know, it's a part of you. It's not this, like, something that society sculpts. Like, your brain has chemicals and stuff going on, and sometimes things don't work right.
Oh, I mean, and mental illness, like, look, I'd rather, you know, get a severe injury to like my leg than have, you know, really bad panic attacks. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd rather go through physical pain than you know, kind of that mental sure. anguish of anxiety and everything. So it's like it's a very real thing, even if it doesn't have a cut or a scar or a broken bone, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, because it's, you know, not something that you can ever escape if it's going on in your head. And right. like I was depressed for a good portion of my life, and it was like, you know, you can't escape it. It's something that like colors everything, and you know, just there's no way to keep yourself from falling back. It's like a magnet, like your brain is a magnet for negative thoughts, and mm-hmm. like there's no light at the end of the tunnel. Like when you're depressed and you're looking at your life and every day is the same exact day over and over and over, it's like, what is the point, you know?
And then
I mean?
You've got people that don't understand it saying like, oh, cheer up, mm-hmm. or you know, if or I'm yeah, just change anxiety attack, chill out, you know, what's the problem? It's like, oh man, like yeah. I'm just so glad it's that's obviously a bigger discussion, but like things are in a much better space
oh,
with that
yeah,
right now.
For
like,
sure.
It's crazy how much.
Well, yeah, and I think that's also a refrain that's pretty common now that a lot of people roll their eyes at, because it's hard to think in the midst of it that it could ever get better. But when people say, you know, it does get better, mm-hmm. it does. Like, it does. If you're, you know, this podcast took a very serious turn, but like...
It's a serious movie.
It is a very serious movie. And you know, obviously the... something as traumatizing as going through war, like that's not something Dan or I have experienced, but just from my experience, like having depression and stuff, like, you know, it's not easy to think that to even have the thought like, okay, it's shitty now, but in a few years it'll be good. Like, it's not even easy to do that, but just trying to, you know, just think about tomorrow, just think yep. small steps, and things do get better. Things get better.
Yeah, that's almost been like a mantra for me if I'm having like a panic attack or just like a general bad anxiety mm-hmm. day. It's like, you know what? This sucks right now, mm-hmm. but I've had this before and it always ends. Mm-hmm. You know, like this always, there's going to be another day. I'm going to wake up and feel fine. Maybe not tomorrow, maybe not the next day, but like this is not a permanent thing,
right,
you know?
Right. So yeah. Yeah. So yeah, when Mike visits Steve in the hospital, that's just such a... That is like probably the scene I remember with most clarity from this movie, is like when he goes to see him and he's just kind of, you could tell, trying to hold back some of his shock at the state of him. Like we said, he's missing both legs. He's partially paralyzed. His mind just isn't there anymore. And
yeah, and he doesn't want to be just like, oh God, what the fuck happened to you? Like yeah. he's trying to be like, hey, good to see you, man. But you can tell, yeah, he's
yeah,
shocked.
Yeah, it's really sad. And I actually read that was one of the most like emotionally difficult scenes for Robert De Niro ever that he's ever filmed.
Really?
So, yeah.
Man. And the actor, I wasn't super familiar with the actor.
John Savage,
yeah. It looks like he's been in a lot of stuff, but I didn't immediately recognize him. He does a really good job of kind of playing that, like, he kind of just, like, it seems like he's more comfortable mm-hmm. with his life just being there and playing bingo and stuff than, like, the idea of having to, like, get back into society, because mm-hmm. Like he's there with other veterans that understand his situation. And obviously, you know, he's not quite all there, mm-hmm. but... he's there enough to know he doesn't want to like leave, and like he's more comfortable in
sure.
this situation
yeah.
at this point, you know?
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, it's hard to blame him. I mean, cause that's everyone, like the only people that are going to understand what you're going through are in the room with you right mm-hmm. at that point. So yeah, he reveals that he's been getting money from Saigon. He doesn't know why. And Nick kind of deduced that it must be, Mike deduced that it must be Nick over there. So he goes over there and, yeah, more good times await.
Oh yeah, Nick's doing great over there. Jesus God. Christ! I know you enjoy a dark ending.
I do enjoy
movies,
a dark ending.
And like this is like Nick's barely like sentient at this. Like he's just like he's hooked on heroin.
Yeah,
he's just making money. You know, just playing Russian roulette.
Just seeing nothing but death all the time.
But just not immune to it, but just numb to it all.
Yeah, completely apathetic and detached. I mean, if he's survived, that means that he's seen probably countless people kill themselves
oh, yeah.
right in front of him.
And it's so telling because like he was the one that was like crying and really mm-hmm. like losing it more than anyone during the Russian roulette scene earlier. And so it really drives home. It's like, oh shit, he has
yeah.
been deep in it.
And on top of all that, like it being a gambling den, people are doing this for money. Like,
and
it's
fun and entertainment.
Yeah. Like someone dies and if it's the person that you bet would die, then you're celebrating. It's
yeah.
just insanity. It's bonkers.
Yeah. yeah, it's and that's pretty much where it wraps up. Yeah. Is like he does have it. Like at first, it seems like he doesn't even really recognize Mike, and then he at the very end he kind of remembers the one shot thing.
Right,
he used
Mike
to say
reminds
about,
him about the deer hunting and everything like that.
Yeah, and he remembers what he used to say about like, oh yeah, one shot. You know, when he kill a deer, and he just shoots himself, and that's the actual bullet, and it's just like De Niro holding his like head with a hole in it, and just crying and. They go back, they have the funeral, because earlier De Niro promised him, you know, if anything happened, he would bring his body back. And I didn't know how to feel about this scene, and also it seems like audiences didn't either. It kind of ends with them all kind of sitting around, and they're just kind of like having some beers and eating at the bar and stuff. And then they go into this like kind of somberish, like they all start singing God Bless America together.
And then Michigan J. Frog comes out. It was really
that was
inappropriate.
Totally, it was not great, yeah.
No, yeah, that was an odd way. Like, I feel like... It just made it seem like that's the thing, like taking the movie as something that is using war as an allegory for like how people respond to different extreme circumstances.
Yeah.
Having them sing God Bless America makes me feel like, wait, was this some kind of weird political commentary or something?
Yeah. And like Walken said during the recording, it's like no one ever even talked about Vietnam or this wasn't a Vietnam movie. No one ever saw it like from behind the scenes to the actors as a Vietnam movie. It was a story about men and the experiences they go with and trauma and stuff like that. And so, yeah, for it to be this like vague, like, is this a political statement? Like I read that people didn't know back then, is this a critique of patriotism or is this meant to be actually genuinely patriotic? Like,
yeah, it was kind of a weird Paul Verhoeven twist on this movie, which I didn't really feel was appropriate or necessary. Yeah, it's not necessary. Yeah.
Yeah, because again, I think that this it used Vietnam and everything as a vessel for this kind of message about trauma and everything. But again, it did not seem like an explicitly like political or, you know, it wasn't specifically about the Vietnam War or the U.S. involvement in it. And so to end with that, I was just kind of like, I don't know how I'm supposed to feel about that.
Yeah,
you know?
I thought it was odd because the fact that they end on something like that means it's trying to say something. But I can't put my finger on exactly what it was because all the explanations that I'm able to come up with are go against what I thought the theme of the movie was. So it's hard for me to kind of resolve that. But, you know, I think when we were talking about watching this movie, I went in with extremely high expectations because of the cast and because of the subject matter and because I had heard of Deer Hunter, know it was considered one of like the best movies.
It won
ever.
Best Picture.
Yeah. I would say that those high expectations might have negatively affected my experience. I thought it was a great movie. I don't think it was one of the best movies I had seen. I was really confused by that ending, and I'm so glad I watched it. You know, I thought epic movies are hard to do well because you know you're dealing with so much stuff, and it's so hard to not get bogged down in one area or not have it drag along in another area or just have a bunch of random unnecessary shit going on. And in that respect, I thought it was really executed really well. And I thought the execution and direction was good. I was confused by some of the content.
Yeah, same here. That said, you know, I do appreciate that it is such a different take on a war movie. And I've just never seen ostensibly a war movie that the war is such a small part of it.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
It's the backdrop of Vietnam and like a few scenes in Vietnam. But like, yeah, it is telling this bigger story here. I thought this was really, really good. I definitely wouldn't put it on the level of like Apocalypse Now or something where I was just like just glued into the movie for every second.
Apocalypse Now was, you know, definitely a war movie, but like it went so beyond that because it was about like the darkness in humanity.
It's a weird, surreal, psychological
God,
like
that movie's so fucking good.
It's every bit of it is from the first, I know we've already done podcasts, but I think about this every once in a while. We hate that song, The End, by The Doors. But whenever I think about that opening, where it's just like you hear that like, and then you see the trees and all the fire and then the song starts, it's just like, oh, we are setting a tone right away with this movie.
And how it's bookmarked with the song on both ends. And how, oh my God, it sets you up in the most appealing, enticing way. He's on this like assassination mission where this colonel has lost his mind. Oh my God, that movie's so good.
Terminate his command with extreme prejudice.
God, I love
gotta
that
go
shit.
Hunt Marlon Brando in the jungle and kill him, and he's so lost. Good. Oh my God, it's the fucking best.
So good.
But no, this was a very good movie. I'm glad we watched it. Mm-hmm. This has really been a year or a few months now of us really ticking off some classic film boxes. Like, I think we started early with Casablanca, uh-huh. but I feel like the last few months between The Godfathers and all the Coppola stuff and this, you know, we're really... and we even we've watched some that we didn't even talk about yeah. here. Very briefly, I'll say we watched Chinatown.
Right.
Which... Nicholson's one of my favorite actors of all time. I think there's just something so cool about him. And he's really cool in this, and he's the lead, and, you know, I like him a lot. But I don't think this... I liked this movie, but I didn't have strong feelings about it, you know?
Yeah, I have same exact... I feel like you and I were on the same exact page when we finished watching it. It was like, you know, it was... I love noirs. I love the tone and stuff like that. But the events were kind of confusing, and I couldn't exactly follow what was going on. And, you know, the whole driving force of the movie being this weird water-based conspiracy yeah. was like kind of like,
That's why I hated Quantum of Solace, that second Daniel Craig one, because it was all about this like water thing. And I was like, what? This is not a good backdrop. This is boring.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was fine. But that's the great thing about this podcast, because we haven't, like, we can watch whatever we want, mm-hmm. and it's just been so nice to finally indulge in all these classic movies that for one reason or another we either saw when we were young and weren't able to appreciate, or we just haven't seen at all. And now, mm-hmm. You know, it's great to be able to, after we watch it, kind of unpack it all with mm-hmm. you here and, you know, have an even deeper appreciation for what we had seen. But, yeah, it's been great. It's yeah. been so great. And I look forward to digging into more classics with you.
Plenty more to come.
Turns out that many of them come from the 70s. Who would have thought? It's just
really
like,
cool decade for movies.
Probably my favorite decade for movies.
There's just something real cool about the music. Oh, God. Again, Apocalypse. I think about the soundtrack and everything. It's so just good. Like puts you in the moment.
Oh,
and,
man.
Like...
The soundtrack was so eerie and good. I would say 70s. Like early 80s is probably my favorite movie, like because I think of Blade Runner being like probably my favorite movie. It's I have to include a little slice of the early 80s,
but. 80s for me, 80s and 90s for like the stuff I grew up watching, like mm-hmm. the action movies, like all the Schwarzenegger, Stallone sure. type stuff, like that was my shit and still is, you know, my whole life. Mm-hmm. But like I definitely am getting more of an appreciation now for the stuff I was probably supposed to watch in college during film school. And it's like, oh, maybe there's a reason they were trying to teach me to watch these movies. So,
yeah, for sure.
But no, it's been awesome. I just love it. And I know there's tons more to come. Deer Hunter is on Peacock. You can watch it on Peacock with ads, or we rented it on Amazon for like $4 without the ads. So, yeah, good movie. Not on the top tier of like an Apocalypse Now, but still a very good movie.
Yeah, I mean, you can't go wrong with De Niro and Christopher Walken.
No, it's 3 hours long, and I don't feel like it really dragged. I was interested the mm-hmm. whole time.
Same.
So that'll be it for our film discussion here. But before we close out, I want to give a special shout out to our patrons.
Thank you.
Can go to patreon.com/paintingthestream.
It's a great website.
It is a great website. It's a place where you can give us $5 a month, and we give you some benefits for that.
Daniel?
We keep it simple. Yeah, $5 a month gets you the ad-free episodes.
Wow.
It gets you episodes a day early. You get it Saturday instead of Sunday. It gets you access to the Discord, which I think has over 600 people in it now.
Holy cannoli, it's a whole little city.
It is, and it's very active, and everyone's real cool. We love it there. We got a painting the stream channel where if you want to talk about this week's or upcoming or past episodes, I've seen people come in there and be like, oh, I've been interested in checking out Painting the Stream. Where should I start? Mm-hmm. And as I always say, just look through the list of what we've done. Pick a movie that I'd say ideally pick a movie or a show that you've seen and would like to hear a conversation mm-hmm. about. Or if it's something you've like, let's say you've never wanted to watch Son of the Mask, but you'd like to hear people mm-hmm. talk about it and you're not worried about spoilers, do that. Or if there's something you'd like to see, maybe watch it first and then listen to the episode.
Yeah, totally. I always like to think of Pan the Stream as like for the people that listen to it every week, it kind of be an excuse to be like, all right, what are we watching for date night? Mm-hmm. What are they covering on Pan the Stream? It'd be an excuse to watch that and then listen to their discussion on it.
Totally.
But
it has been fun for us to,
of course,
yes, to watch. Did we watch this on a date night?
We did watch it on date night.
Yeah, we had a nice dinner together.
Oh my god, so good.
Yes.
Since we're leaving Stanford soon, we're like using that as an excuse to check out restaurants we hadn't.
Because we've been living here for a year and it's been like full-blown pandemic. Yeah. So
it's always been like takeout from the same places. So we went out finally, obviously very socially distant. Mm-hmm. There was only a few people in the restaurant, but oh my god, I had the best thing I'd ever put in my mouth before. It was this sticky bread
Grandma's
pudding.
Grandma's sticky date pudding.
It was amazing. It was like this really creamy cold ice cream and then this dense like caramelly cake. Oh my God, it was incredible.
It was unreal.
If you're ever in Stamford, go to Flinders or Flinders Lane.
Yeah, get a meat pie.
Oh my God, those meat pies and the shishito peppers.
And the fries were incredible.
Fries had like a little bit of vinegar on them. They were so
perfect.
Good.
It was perfect. but with all that said, there is also one more benefit you get your patronage, and that is a Bonku written for you by Bonk. Bonk, do we have someone this week?
We sure do, Daniel.
Who do we got?
This week, we are honoring our friend Samuel.
Hello, Samuel.
Samuel, I hope you're doing well out there in the wide world, and I hope this graces your ear holes and makes you feel funny.
Sure.
I thought Samuel took the ducks to work last night. I thought Samuel took the ducks to work last night for the board meeting.
I like that one.
In case you were wondering where the ducks went, Samuel took them to work for the board meeting.
Well, because of the tenor of a lot of the Bonkus, I was worried it was going to be some dark thing where they opened up a portal to hell or something, or they murdered a man. But they just went to a board meeting.
Samuel. You got off easy.
All right, Samuel. Hope you enjoy that board meeting with the ducks.
You have a lot of ducks to get in a row.
And we've got a Hugh Game card right here. Question of the week here from the Hugh Game is, what's the most important school subject?
Most important school subject.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Take that.
Health class, maybe? Because you learn that's something that affects everyone.
I guess, yeah.
I don't know. Science. I don't know. Any of them.
Great answer.
I think probably the most important subject in school is probably the one that's not actually a subject, but just the socialization aspect.
I would agree. Yeah, getting to just learn how to be with other humans and talk to them. And yeah. If I had to pick a subject, I would say early-ish. Like, I'd say math up to, like, once it starts getting, like, you know, calculus and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I think just a basic understanding of addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, and you know, geometry and things like that. Like, practical math, you know, because numbers you have to deal with numbers a lot between, especially as you get older and you're paying taxes mm-hmm. and you're budgeting stuff and you're, you know, getting a house and measuring things mm-hmm. and everything. I just feel like a grasp on the fundamentals of numbers is very important.
I feel like there's a basic level of math that we should all possess, a basic knowledge of math that we should all possess just to function in society. Then there's a step beyond that that gets into more like theoretical stuff that like isn't going to affect your daily life. And that's only if you want to dip your toes into that only to like level up your intelligence skill. It's not really applicable to everyday life.
Yeah, there was a distinct moment in like, I want to say like ninth grade or so, where it's like up until that point, I was known as like kind of a math whiz. Mm-hmm. I was like math and spelling. I was just like insane.
Math whiz kid, Dan Record.
That was me. That's
Nat
what the teacher said.
Tracker.
Nat Tracker, math whiz. But you know, I was super good at math and spelling. And then in like ninth grade or so, I just like would start looking at these problems and these theorems mm-hmm. and all this stuff and just be like, man, I just can't see it. I can't mm-hmm. see myself using this. And I just like, you know, went from A pluses in every math class to like not caring and suddenly getting C's and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
But I think up until that point, which that may change with everyone, depending on what you want to get into.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, if you want to build airplanes or something, you need to keep going on.
Of course. Of course. But yeah, I just think like just generally speaking, I think like your whole education up into eighth grade is probably good to have in your back pocket.
Yes.
Beyond that, you're getting into more specializations that might may or may not affect your life depending on what you decide to pursue.
And maybe like that is the moment, like once they start teaching that stuff, that you start realizing what, like maybe that's when some people really dive mm-hmm. harder into it mm-hmm. and they're like, oh, maybe I want to go into engineering or I want to go into this type of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then people like me are like, okay, I'm going to start cutting off those type of like math heavy careers as something I would do, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, that's a good argument.
Yeah. Well, that's our episode on the Deer Hunter.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you all for listening to us.
Thank you so much.
And Bonk, thank you as always for sitting across from me.
Well, thank
here.
You, darling. Thank you for being a great podcast host and a great husband.
Oh, gee. Well, this is, you know what? This is one of the last ones that is going to be recorded in this pizone here. Mm. We will have maybe one or two more, probably two at least, but we'll see. But we'll keep you abreast of the situation. Hopefully there won't be that much of a change in audio quality or whatever. I think we'll be up and running before too long. And it's important to me, not miss a Sunday. We've never missed a single Sunday.
Nary a Sunday.
Nary a Sunday has been missed for Painting the Stream, and we hope to see you all next Sunday. Thanks to Tom Hunter for the theme song. We'll see you all next week.
Bye.
Bye.